Kurt Sova was the eldest son of Dorothy and Kenneth Sova, living in Newburg Heights, Ohio. A smart boy with a lot of focus, he was attending school and, due to his good behavior and grades, was given a decent amount of freedom by his parents. Kurt wasn't the type of kid to cause too much trouble or fail to come home when his curfew was up, at least not without calling first. On the night of Friday, October 23rd, 1981, Kurt had plans to go to a local carnival. Plans changed, though, when Kurt ran into one of his friends who mentioned a party that was taking place in a duplex. The duplex was rented out by mutual friends, and excited by the change of plans, Kurt rushed over to the party and found a busy scene. During the party, Kurt is said to have drank a little too heavily. Word would later circulate that Kurt had been drinking alcohol almost all day, specifically 190 proof Everclear. The drinking caught up to Kurt, and according to his friend, he needed to step outside since he might be sick. Kurt's friend walked him out, where he leaned Kurt up against a fence. The night was getting cold, and Kurt's friend went back inside to get their jackets. When he returned just a moment later, Kurt had vanished. After searching around the area, Kurt's friends assumed he had either walked home or caught a ride with some other friends. Kurt never returned home that night. His mother had already been out looking for him since he was running late, and that wasn't like Kurt. Though it was unusual, Kurt had always been very responsible, and so his parents assumed he'd show up. When the next morning came, and it was clear that Kurt had never arrived, Ken and Dorothy filed a missing persons report. The search began with the family looking in spots that Kurt was known to frequent, speaking to friends, and overall, hoping that he was all right. Over the course of the next 5 days, the case would involve several bizarre incidents, as multiple people reported seeing Kurt at the party that night, but the owner denied Kurt had ever been there or that there had even been a party. A homeless man from Detroit told a local store manager that Kurt was going to be found and that authorities wouldn't know what happened to him. A friend of Kurt's later alleged that he had seen Kurt walking down the side of the road during the period in which he was missing. And the duplex owner later admitted that Kurt had been at the party and then later claimed that someone fitting Kurt's description had been sleeping in the basement. On October 28th, Kurt's body was discovered by some children playing in an abandoned area. There were no outward signs of trauma, and a medical examiner failed to locate a cause of death. Strangely, Kurt was dressed in the same clothes he had worn the night he disappeared, but he wasn't wearing any shoes. His left shoe was located at the scene, but his right shoe was never recovered. Police ruled the death an accident, though Ken Sova was emphatic that he had just searched that area the day before and Kurt hadn't been there. Kurt's mother felt her son had been the victim of foul play, and there was also some concern about the Newburgh Heights Police Department, and specifically, lead investigator Robert Karras, both of whom had a reputation for cutting corners and corruption. Just 3 months after Kurt's body was found, the body of another young boy was discovered. 13-year-old Eugene Cavett, a boy Kurt had known and who lived close by, was discovered in a ravine. His death, too, was ruled the result of an accident. But in a strange coincidence, Eugene's right shoe was also not recovered from the location where his body was found. Kurt's parents fought to get justice for their son. They begged other agencies to examine the case, feeling that the Newburgh Heights police had dismissed their son's death and failed to investigate fully. Eventually, the state's district attorney's office, as well as the FBI, would get involved, and a slew of unrelated charges would be filed, but questions about Kurt's death lingered. What happened to Kurt Sova? Was his death truly the result of an accident? Could Kurt have been murdered by someone at the party that night? Is there a connection between the deaths of Kurt Sova and Eugene Cuvette? Did the homeless man play a role in this disturbing death? Or did the Newburgh Heights police and Detective Robert Karras know much more than they were saying and possibly play a role in the death themselves? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 40, The Mysterious Death of Kurt Sova, Revisited. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today's episode is a re-examination of the mysterious death of Kurt Sova, the case featured in the very first episode of Trace Evidence. In the past year, a lot has changed about this show, and being that this is one of the cases which sparked my interest in true crime, I wanted to take the time to go back and give it the proper attention I wasn't able to back then. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and missing persons. Trace Evidence is available across all platforms and can be found on iTunes, Google Play Music, iHeartRadio, SoundCloud, YouTube, and many more. Further information, including full episodes, transcripts, merchandise, social media links, YouTube videos, and much more, can be found on the website at trace-evidence.com. Trace Evidence has a Patreon for those of you who wish to support the podcast. Patrons receive shoutouts, stickers, ad-free episodes, and special updates. This podcast is a complete one-man operation, so if you wish to help, please check out the Patreon page at patreon.com/traceevidence. Donations can also be made via PayPal for those of you who wish to help but don't want to use Patreon. There is a PayPal donation button on the website. If you'd like to contact me, you can email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Find me on Twitter at traceevpod. That's TRACEEVPOD. Add me on Instagram at traceevidencepod or join the Trace Evidence discussion group on Facebook simply by searching for Trace Evidence or clicking the direct link on the website. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, I'd love to hear from you. As a final note, if you enjoy the show, please rate and review it on whatever app or platform you're listening on. The more ratings and reviews the show gets, the easier it becomes to find the podcast, and the more attention can be given to the cases that I cover. Today's episode examines the mysterious death of Kurt Sova. It's a very sad story, with a lot of twists and turns. There are so many questions which have remained for the past 37 years, and for many, it's a case which will always haunt them. This is episode 40, The Mysterious Death of Kurt Sova. Kurt Sova was born on July 15, 1964, in Cuyahoga County, Ohio, to parents Kenneth and Dorothy. A quiet boy with a close circle of friends, Kurt was described by his family as being kind, intelligent, and dependable. Kurt was the oldest son, later having three brothers. He often aided his parents in looking after his siblings and took his responsibility seriously. Ken and Dorothy were loving parents who provided him with a support system and did their best to raise a polite son who was never known to get into trouble. Somewhat of an introvert, as Kurt aged, he began to expand his horizons and his personality blossomed. By the time he turned 17 in 1981, He was well on his way to becoming the driven and reliable man he'd been raised to be. While many kids Kurt's age enter into a rebellious period, he hadn't caused too much grief, and for the most part, continued to follow the rules set by his parents, but he was still a teenager. Considering his maturity and his tendency to steer clear of troubling situations, Kurt was granted a fair amount of leeway when it came to his curfew and activities with friends. Also, it was the early 1980s, and much of the more carefree nature of the 70s still lingered. That sense of innocence of living in a small, safe town also lent credence to Ken and Dorothy's more relaxed approach. Of her son, Dorothy later said, quote, "He never had any trouble with the neighbors. I never had any trouble with him in school. I never had any trouble with him with the police." End quote. While Kurt's parents found him to be respectable and innocent, for lack of a better term, friends described him slightly differently. Kurt was 17, and like many boys his age, wasn't afraid to break some rules in order to have some fun. Several of his closer friends, interviewed later, suggested that it wasn't uncommon for the group of them, including Kurt, to get their hands on some alcohol or spend their nights drinking, smoking cigarettes, and even indulging in marijuana when they could find it. This isn't exactly unusual behavior for someone his age, as many kids partake in these kinds of activities as they make the slow progression from teenager to adult. Unfortunately for Kurt, he could never complete the transition, and his death would become a bizarre mystery full of confusion and rumor, leading many to wonder what could have happened in his final hours to leave such a young boy deceased with no proper explanation. On the morning of Friday, October 23rd, 1981, Kurt woke up and began his daily ritual, preparing for school and helping with his brothers. According to Ken and Dorothy, it was a typical Friday, and Kurt was excited for the weekend. Halloween was coming up, and a carnival was in town. Kurt had plans of going to the carnival that night, and as far as Ken and Dorothy knew, he would be attending school as per usual. However, outside of his parents' knowledge, Kurt had no plans on going to school that day. According to reports of the time, Kurt cut school that morning and instead went to the parking lot of a liquor store where he would try to persuade an adult to buy some alcohol for him. Allegedly, Kurt was successful and scored a bottle of 190 proof Everclear. 190 proof means that the liquor was 95% pure alcohol, making it extremely potent. While it has been said that Kurt was known to drink with his friends, it's never been made clear whether or not they typically drank large quantities of something that strong. Since he was out of school but couldn't go home, Kurt is alleged to have spent a large part of the morning and some of the afternoon at a girlfriend's house. Later in the day, he ran into a friend, Samuel Carroll. Kurt talked about going to the carnival to have some fun, but Carroll mentioned a party that was happening. Kurt is said to have been somewhat drunk at this time and agreed to go to the party instead. The party was being hosted by Debbie Sams and her brother Clayton at a duplex on Harvard Avenue, which they shared with a female roommate. Upon arriving at the party, there were several people there that Kurt and Carroll knew, although there were reportedly others they were unfamiliar with. Reports would later say that the party had been attended by several people who had traveled in from Detroit, located only a few hours' drive away. What exactly occurred at the party that night has been a heated point of contention in this case, with some suggesting that Kurt seemed normal, though a little drunk, and others saying that Kurt was incredibly drunk and causing a scene. Witnesses who attended the party would later say that Kurt was drinking Everclear, Though no one can say for sure whether it was his own bottle that he'd gotten earlier that day, or if he'd picked up another one, or if there was simply Everclear at the party. Either way, multiple attendees described Kurt as visibly drunk. According to Carol, Kurt became ill at the party and vomited. In an interview, Carol later stated, quote, "The roommate asked me to please get him out of the house, so I helped him down the stairs and outside," end quote. According to Carol, in the transition from later afternoon to night, the temperature had dropped off significantly, and neither he nor Kurt were dressed for it. They had worn jackets, but had taken them off inside the duplex. Carol later said that he and Kurt stood around for 20 to 30 minutes near a chain-link fence behind the duplex, talking, while Kurt tried to sober up, or at least feel less sick. Carol explained that, after some time had passed, he wanted to go inside and get their jackets, because he was freezing. He left Kurt standing against the chain-link fence, and according to Carol, quote, "I then went to go and get the jackets upstairs. I got the jackets and went back down, and he wasn't there. I was only upstairs about 2 or 3 minutes," end quote. Carol wasn't sure where Kurt had gone, so he began wandering around calling out his name. According to Carol, he walked up and down several side streets and checked the nearby parking lot of a J.L. Goodman warehouse. But after failing to locate Kurt, he assumed his friend had decided to go home or had met someone he knew, later saying, quote, "I can only guess that someone he knew picked him up because it happened that fast. Someone had to pick him up in a car," end quote. At that point, Carol returned to the party. Around this same time, Dorothy Sova was driving around town looking for Kurt. It had gotten late, and it was unlike him to not come home, or at least to not call and let his parents know that he was going to be late or spending the night with a friend. Neither Dorothy nor Ken had seen Kurt since 7:30 that morning, when they were under the impression that he was getting ready for school. They wouldn't find out that he'd taken the day off until later. Dorothy visited several locations she knew Kurt often spent time, but failed to locate him. She returned home, and, assuming that he would be home sometime, eventually fell asleep. When she awoke the next morning and found Kurt's bed empty and not slept in at all, she began to panic. Dorothy later said, quote, "It was not like him to be gone overnight. It was not like him to stay out after 10, 10:30, 11 o'clock at the latest. And that was only when we knew where he was. This night, he just never came home," end quote. Ken and Dorothy made several phone calls and, early the next morning, had assembled many friends, neighbors, and even some of Kurt's friends to help search for him. The group split up and searched different areas, looking in ravines, alleys, and even dumpsters, but they found no sign of him. According to Dorothy, quote, "We were in teams. We must have had 40 people out looking for him, day and night," end quote. They searched for hours, but could find no trace of Kurt. Saturday slowly began dwindling, and Kurt was now missing for more than 24 hours. His parents placed multiple calls to friends, trying to get any information they could, but they failed to find anyone who had seen Kurt the night before, or at least, anyone who was willing to admit to seeing him the night before. The next day, on Sunday, October 25th, Dorothy and Ken filed a missing persons report with the Cleveland Police Department, while their other sons printed up flyers bearing Kurt's photo and vital information. The flyers were posted all over town, on power poles, fences, and even the windows of businesses. Almost from the onset, Kurt's parents felt that the police weren't taking the case seriously and began conducting their own investigation. They started questioning everyone they knew who was friends with or who had even ever met Kurt. But again, they failed to dig up any information or leads on where their son could be. Each day that passed brought more fear and panic into their lives. They knew that if Kurt could, he would have contacted them by now, and they just knew something was wrong. Finally, their searching paid off, and someone told them about the party at the duplex. Dorothy went to the duplex herself, but the owner was uncooperative and alleged that not only had she never seen nor heard of Kurt, but that she hadn't had a party either. Police later interviewed several people who had been at the party, and they named Kurt as an attendee. In addition to this, they spoke with a pizza delivery man who reported making a delivery on Friday night to the duplex, and he specified that there was definitely a party going on. Confronted with this information, the woman changed her story, saying that yes, there had in fact been a party, and she knew Kurt had attended, though she wasn't sure what had happened, and that he had left. The owner, along with all attendees of the party who had been questioned, failed to report anything out of the ordinary or any incidents occurring other than Kurt being somewhere between mildly to excessively drunk. Kurt's family paid several visits to the duplex and ultimately were given his jacket, which had been left behind during the party. After more visits, the owner filed a complaint with the Newburgh Heights Police Department, and Chief James F. Lucas spoke to the Sovas, telling them that they needed to stay away from the duplex and its owner. On Monday, October 26th, Judy Oros had a bizarre encounter. Judy worked at a music store, and in the front window was one of the flyers Kurt's brothers had printed up. There had been a homeless man hanging around the area for a few days, allegedly from Detroit, and he had made bizarre statements to people during the course of those days. During one particular encounter, the man alleged that he had access to bodies that were being flown into Cleveland Hopkins International Airport, and that he had, on several occasions, stolen shoes from those bodies. People who came across the man found him to be creepy and likely crazy, and tried to steer clear of him. According to Oros, the man entered the store and approached her, gesturing towards the flyer with Kurt's face on it. He is alleged to have said, quote, "They're gonna find him, and they're gonna find him in 2 days, and they're not gonna know what happened to him," end quote. Disturbed and frightened by this statement, Oros contacted police, who took her statement and said they would look for the man and to give them a call if he returned. The following day, Ken and Dorothy were informed that Kurt may still be in the duplex. Who the source was can't be confirmed. Some articles have reported that the owner of the duplex told them directly that a young man who fit Kurt's description had been sleeping on a cot in the basement for days. Other sources have reported that it was an anonymous source who contacted the family and told them the same story, though there doesn't seem to be any direct confirmation of which story is true. Regardless, Ken Sova took his sons with him and returned to the duplex. Finding no one home, they broke in the door and proceeded down into the basement. They did find a cot down there, which appeared to have been recently slept in, but there was no sign of Kurt. Ken later said, quote, "I went down to the basement. I thought maybe he was sick or he was hurt, and I figured if I got down there and found him, that maybe I could do something for him. There, I found a cot that looked like somebody had slept in it. After searching the whole basement, I didn't find anybody there. I had no idea if Kurt was hurt or not. All I know is somebody did sleep in that cot that night, and when I got there, they were gone." End quote. Frustrated and desperate for answers, the Sova family continued their search. Eventually, Kurt's friend who had accompanied him to the party, Samuel Carroll, came forward and spoke to the family. It's not clear why there'd been such a delay in this conversation, though some have suggested that Carol was afraid of getting into trouble, while others believe Carol knew more than he was willing to admit about Kurt's whereabouts. For the next few days, the search continued, but no new information or leads about Kurt, his whereabouts, or his condition were found. According to Ken Sova, on October 27th, he passed through and thoroughly checked the area of a ravine where local kids often hung out, but it was empty. The next day, on October 28th, 5 days after Kurt had attended the party, at approximately 5:30 p.m., three local boys were playing behind the J.L. Goodman warehouse on Harvard Avenue. They began making their way through a steel yard and then into the abandoned area that Ken Sova said he had searched the previous day. On this day, the boys made the disturbing discovery of a human body lying face up in a puddle. Scared and unsure what to do, the boys ran as fast as they could and came across a man working in the area. They told him what they had seen, and not believing them at first, the man went to check for himself. After confirming their story, the man phoned the police to report the body. Officers arrived on the scene and quickly identified the victim as the missing Kurt Sova. Kurt's body was described as being laid out in a crucifixion-like pose, with his arms out to his sides and one foot propped on top of the other. Paul T. Grzyk, a part-time patrolman at the time, later stated, quote, "When we arrived there, his body was laid out like Christ on the cross," end quote. Kurt was still dressed in the clothes he had worn to the party 5 days earlier. Interestingly, Kurt didn't show any obvious outward signs that would suggest a cause of death. One bizarre detail discovered was that Kurt's shoes were missing. While police searched the area to sweep for evidence, they did manage to locate his left shoe, buried in a pile of rocks nearby. His right shoe was never found. Unable to determine a possible cause of death at the scene, and failing to discover any forensic evidence, Kurt's remains were taken to the medical examiner's office. Chief Deputy Coroner Dr. Lester Adelson was surprised by the condition of the body. There were minor cuts and scrapes, and some bruising on the shins and cheek, but no indication of a lethal wound. There were no knife wounds, gunshots, or puncture marks to indicate a needle. Baffled by this, a thorough examination was conducted. Toxicology was run, which came up negative for cocaine and LSD. Kurt's blood alcohol content was listed as 0.11%, slightly over the legal limit in the United States, which is 0.8%. With nothing to indicate foul play, Kurt's cause of death was ruled to be of natural causes, though it was later reclassified as a probable accident. Dr. Adelson later said, quote, "You can stop the machinery without damaging the machinery. The manner of death in this particular case was signed out as a probable accident. He hadn't been beaten in any way. He hadn't been traumatized in any way. He didn't have enough alcohol to end his life. He had no pre-existing natural disease. As Sherlock Holmes said, you eliminate all other possibilities, and that which remains is the truth. This was a diagnosis by exclusion," end quote. According to the Cuyahoga County Coroner, Elizabeth Belraj, of the approximate 1,200 autopsies they perform each year, the cause of death cannot be determined in only one or two cases. Kurt's family were absolutely devastated by the news that his body had been found. Being beyond heartbroken, they were angry and frustrated. Ken and Dorothy didn't believe that Kurt had died as the result of any kind of accident, and firmly felt that foul play had been involved. Ken was adamant that he had searched the area just the day before Kurt was found, and at that time, his body hadn't been there. Ken later stated, quote, "I know he wasn't there the day I was searching. They must have dumped him off that evening. I looked around, and I'm sure that if Kurt was down there, I would have noticed that bright yellow t-shirt that he had on against any of the terrain." End quote. Ken demanded to see Kurt's body, and the coroner acquiesced. According to Ken, quote, "I felt sort of hurt because there was mud on his face, and they didn't even wipe him off. He looked cold. He looked so cold. He was lying there as if to say, 'Dad, I'm so cold. Take me home.'" End quote. Kurt's parents had difficulty accepting that the coroner was unable to determine a confirmed cause of death, but police accepted the coroner's statement and closed the case, feeling that there was no indications that they were dealing with a homicide. This would be the catalyst for a great deal of strife between local authorities and the Sova family. Dorothy Sova, when asked about the unknown cause of death, responded, quote, "I didn't believe they couldn't tell me how Kurt died. For my peace of mind, I want to know what happened to my boy." End quote. The lead detective on Kurt's case was Robert Karras, and while Dorothy tried to convince him that something more had gone on, Karras wasn't interested. He tried to tell Dorothy that she was still grieving and in denial, that it was understandable, but that they had found nothing that justified further investigation. According to Karras, Kurt had likely gotten a little too drunk that night, and when he'd left the party, he could have done any number of things which could have resulted in his accidental death. Dorothy disagreed and was determined to find the answers on her own. News of Kurt's death swept through town, and those who knew Kurt or the Sova family in general reached out to send their condolences and well wishes. Kurt's body was laid to rest in Holy Cross Cemetery in nearby Brook Park. Ken and Dorothy promised their son that they would find the truth about what had happened to him, and following his memorial service, they began their search for answers. On Thursday morning, 2 days after Kurt's body had been discovered, music store manager Judy Oros had another disturbing experience. A shopkeeper nearby stopped at her store and told her that the homeless man had left a bouquet of roses for her. Attached to the roses was a note which read, quote, "Roses are red, the sky is blue. They found him dead, and they'll find you too." End quote. Horrified and scared, Oros placed a call to the Newburgh Heights police, who sent two detectives down to speak with her. At this time, the homeless man appeared in the area, and according to Oros, the detectives took him into their vehicle to question him. Oros later told a reporter, quote, "They took him outside and were sitting in their car with him. They checked him out. They told me he was just some wacko from Detroit." End quote. The man was released by police, ruled out as having any possible involvement in Kurt's death, and was never seen in the area again. Several days before Kurt's body was discovered, a local woman named Angeline Reddick had witnessed a strange sight. Angeline was looking out the window of her home on Washington Park Boulevard when she saw two men carrying a third. According to Reddick, quote, "I seen them taking a boy down the alley. It was just before Halloween. One foot was barefoot. I'm almost sure it was the right one. I figured a couple of teenagers with a couple of beers too many, and they're trying to sober him up." End quote. According to Reddick, after the discovery of the body, she wanted to contact police, but her husband didn't want them to get involved, fearing that whoever had killed Kurt could possibly come after them. Reddick later said she ran into the Sova family at a later date and told them what she had seen. Dorothy told the story to the Newburgh Heights police, and they said they'd follow up on it. But according to Reddick, no police ever came to question her about the incident. Dorothy later said, quote, "I'm not surprised they didn't interview her. They didn't interview half of the people who came to me with stuff. Karis kept playing me off as the mother who could not accept her son's death." End quote. The Sovas continued looking for information, and later spoke to a friend of Kurt's named David Trusnik, who had an interesting story. According to Trusnik, 3 days after Kurt had disappeared, he was driving down a nearby road on his way to a job interview. As he drove, he saw Kurt and another boy on the side of the road less than a mile from the Sova residence. Trusnik would go on to say that he clearly recognized Kurt, so he pulled to the side of the road to offer him a ride. Trusnik said, quote, "At this point, a van pulled up and Kurt yelled out the name Franco. They both ran over to the van and they got in. I didn't know Kurt was missing. If I would have known he was missing, there would probably have been something I could have done. I could have followed the van, but I didn't know. And 2 days later, he was found dead, and that was the last time I saw him." End quote. Again, Dorothy brought this to the police, but they continued to dismiss her information. Dorothy began investigating any deaths which shared even remote similarities to Kurt's. Some 4 months after Kurt's body was found, the body of 13-year-old Eugene Cavette, who, also in a strange coincidence, lived just one block north of the Sovas, was found in another ravine off Harvard Avenue. In a bizarre similarity, Eugene's right shoe was also missing, just like Kurt's had been. The coroner's office ultimately ruled that Cavette's death came as the result of him falling into the ravine, and while Dorothy could accept this, she still felt it was strange and that there was more here than the police were willing to look into. For months, she fought to get Kurt's case reinvestigated, contacting several other police departments and agencies. Over the course of the next few years, 4 law enforcement agencies reinvestigated Kurt's death, but were unable to come up with answers. Each time they explained that the case had grown too cold, and their initial investigation, conducted by the Newburgh Heights police, had been sloppy and left them with very little to work with. 18 months after Kurt's death, Dorothy's campaigning paid off. Cleveland Police Department Detective Al Figler agreed to look into the case and reinvestigate. Figler's first move was to request the case file from the Newburgh Heights police, but he was shocked with what he received. According to Figler, quote, "When I talked to Karis, there must have been 3 or 4 pieces of paper thrown in a manila folder with 4 Polaroids. It was a joke. Basic detective work would demand more documents than that." End quote. Figler's investigation continued to unearth poor work, and possibly even direct attempts to dismiss Kurt's case and simply brush it under the rug as an accidental death. It became clear to everyone in a professional capacity who examined the case that Dorothy Sova was not simply a grieving mother who refused to let go of her son. The Newburgh Heights Police Department, at a minimum, had not devoted enough attention or time to Kurt's case, and at a maximum, had actively worked to cover up and conceal the true facts. Due to a lack of evidence, an improper investigation, and uncooperative investigators, there wasn't much which could be done in Kurt's case. But those who did look into it felt that the official ruling was incorrect, and that there was enough information to suggest that Kurt's death may not have been accidental. Unfortunately, little could be done at the time. 9 long years would pass, with the Sova family consistently arguing that someone had murdered Kurt, and that the Newburgh Heights police either knew who had done it and were covering up for him, or they simply chose to ignore obvious clues and information which could have led to answers. While the Newburgh Heights police felt that they had done nothing wrong, things would shift years later when further investigations into their activities would result in terminations and arrests. In 1990, 9 years after Kurt's death, the case was reopened by the prosecutor's office. Cuyahoga County Assistant Prosecutor James A. Gutierrez said about the original investigation, quote, "The initial investigation done by the Newburgh Heights police was a joke. A joke. If I had known about some of this stuff earlier, I probably would have indicted some people on dereliction of duty. There was no police investigation whatsoever. It's unbelievable. The people who ran Newburgh Heights from a law enforcement perspective in the early 80s ought to be ashamed of themselves." End quote. Police Chief Lucas disagreed with Gutierrez, stating, quote, "I felt it was a pretty good investigation, based on the fact that we really didn't have a lot to go on. Nobody would even talk. We didn't have a cause of death, and that was the biggest problem. If they would have at least given us a cause of death, we would have had something to go on." End quote. When the prosecutor's office dug into the case, they made several disturbing discoveries. Polaroid crime scene photos showed Kurt's body on a stretcher, but not the position that he had been in when first discovered. When asked about why they had no photos of the crime scene before the body was moved, Chief Lucas responded, quote, "I know there were photos taken. I'm almost positive there were photos." End quote. Lucas was further questioned as to why no forensic specialists were called into the scene, which had been processed predominantly by detectives and patrolmen. Lucas explained that they were a small police department and, at that time, didn't have a forensics team. Other police departments, when asked about this, explained that the Newburgh Heights police should have called the Cleveland police and asked them to send a forensic specialist down. Dorothy Sova would later claim that the Cleveland police had offered to send a forensics team shortly after the body had been discovered, but that the Newburgh Heights police had rejected the offer. The prosecutor's office also asked Chief Lucas why they never obtained a warrant for the duplex where the Samses lived, since they had witness statements, as well as an admission from the owner, that a party had been held the night Kurt disappeared, and that he had, in fact, been present at the party. In addition to those facts, they also had received information that someone resembling Kurt may have been staying on a cot in the basement days after the party had taken place. Chief Lucas simply responded, quote, "We had no reason to search it," end quote. Suffice it to say, the way in which the Newburgh Heights police handled Kurt's death was seriously called into question, labeled as unprofessional and borderline negligent. The controversy around Kurt's death, among other accusations, led to a deeper investigation into the Newburgh Heights Police Department. Chief Lucas was officially removed from his position and permanently fired from the police department. According to reports of the time, Lucas had been caught falsifying police credentials and giving them to a 911 dispatcher working for the department. Lucas had previously been reprimanded in 1984 for an incident where the police chief was off duty and present at a party where illegal gambling was taking place. He was found guilty of dereliction of duty. When asked about these incidents later, and whether or not he had shown dereliction when it came to Kurt's case, Lucas was adamant that it was unfair to use these errors in judgment against him, stating, quote, "That's not even fair. What happened was completely unrelated. That's the only part I take offense to. The Sova case was handled on the up and up," end quote. After further accusations of abuse of power, corruption, and physical abuse against the Newburgh Heights Police Department, the FBI officially launched an investigation. While Chief Lucas was merely fired and banned from ever being a police officer again, the lead detective on Kurt's case, Robert Karras, had much greater charges to contend with. At the conclusion of the FBI's investigation, Detective Robert Karras was charged with brutally beating five crime suspects during his time with the Newburgh Heights Police, though speculation was rampant that there were quite a few more. One of the suspects he was charged with beating was a man named Eric Katonsky. According to Katonsky, Karras accused him of driving while under the influence of alcohol, which he denied. Karras demanded that Katonsky turn over his car keys, and when he refused, Karras bashed him over the head with a flashlight. Katonsky was sent to the hospital, but Karras came along and drove him to the police station afterward for processing. According to Katonsky, on the way to the station, Karras took a detour and drove him to a desolate area where he stopped and exited the vehicle, taunting and threatening his handcuffed prisoner. Katonsky would later state, quote, "He took me behind the J.L. Goodman furniture, but I wouldn't get out of the car. I had already been beaten up once, and I wasn't going to go through it again," end quote. It should be noted that the area where Karras had driven Katonsky was the very same place where Kurtsova's body had been found. Karras was ultimately found guilty of five beatings which had taken place between 1988 and 1989, making many believe that it was unlikely he'd only committed these brutal assaults during that short period of time. As it turned out, though, assault wasn't the only crime that Detective Karras had committed. In addition to investigating these crimes, the FBI came upon rumors that the detective had been involved in drug trafficking. In 1990, Karras was charged, found guilty, and convicted of 76 counts of aggravated drug trafficking and illegal processing of drug documents. Most, if not all of the counts, were related to the powerful painkiller Percocet. As a result of his crimes, Robert Karras was placed on leave and ultimately fired from the Newburgh Heights Police Department. Karras continued to be uncooperative in relation to Kurt's case, with Detective Sergeant Don Mester of the Sheriff's Department taking over. Mester would later say, quote, "We had a very difficult time getting records from Karras and the Newburgh Heights Police Department, but as long as I'm here, we'll consider this case open," end quote. Assistant Prosecutor Gutierrez later directly asked Karras if he was involved in Kurt's death, though Karras denied it. The corruption of the Newburgh Heights Police Department had been exposed, and the lead detective on Kurt's case was found to be worse than many of the criminals they dealt with week in and week out. But for the Sova family, questions remained, and the answers were nowhere to be found. No amount of arrests or convictions could bring their son back, and even though they'd seen the police department cleared of those who had ignored their pleas for so long, there was no movement on Kurt's case. The mystery of why their son had died remained unanswered, and for Dorothy, it was a bitter battle that left the family struggling for the truth. In an interview, she later said, quote, "It has taken 10 years of our lives. It has literally crushed our family. Sometimes I think I should just take all this stuff and throw it in the fire and get on with my life. But you can't go on with your life because you're constantly hearing about different things," end quote. When asked about Kurt, Dorothy responded, quote, "I remember all the good things, the fun things about him. Oh God, he was just a lovable boy," end quote. In the 37 years since Kurtsova's body was found, the questions have only continued to mount. a botched investigation by a corrupt detective, an inability for a medical examiner to give a definitive cause of death, statements from witnesses contradicting one another, and rumors abounding in a community that could never truly understand what happened. In the absence of verifiable truth, multiple theories have been put forth as to try and piece together the puzzle of the tragic and bizarre death of 17-year-old Kurt Sova. The first theory is that Kurt's death was, as the official file states, a probable accident. Supporters of this theory suggest that Kurt likely drank too much during the course of that Friday and may have mixed it with other illicit substances, resulting in his death. Theorists go on to speculate that Kurt likely died at the party that night and that his body was hidden and then placed in the ravine in order to protect those who had been at the party from getting into any kind of trouble for providing an underage boy with liquor and possibly other drugs, which resulted in his death. The second theory is that Kurt Sova's death was no accident and that he was likely the victim of foul play. Believers of this theory suggest that Kurt may have been murdered by someone present at the party. They point to the fact that the 17-year-old didn't know many of the attendees, some of whom were not local to the area and had driven in from Detroit. Others believe an incident occurred at the party, and Kurt was targeted as a result of his drunken behavior, while others still think that Kurt's friend, Samuel Carroll, may have been somehow involved, and that the entire story about his disappearing from outside could be completely made up. Tied into the idea of foul play, there's the homeless man who made the strange statements about Kurt being found dead days before he was found dead. Many believe this man may have been involved in Kurt's death, either having played a role in it or witnessing it. Others believe that the homeless man knew nothing about the case and was simply mentally unstable and made his bizarre, though later prophetic statements, based on possessing no actual knowledge of Kurt or his death. The homeless man made statements about stealing shoes, and for many, this directly connects the deaths of Kurt Sova and Eugene Cavett, though this has been a point of great contention among theorists. The third and final theory is that Kurt Sova's death was in some way related to the corruption within the Newburgh Heights Police Department. Some have speculated that lead investigator Karras murdered Kurt, being that his body was found in the location Karras was known to beat suspects in. Some have gone so far as to speculate that Kurt may have witnessed Karras dealing drugs, or may have purchased drugs from him, which led to an accidental overdose. Many believe that Karras slanted the investigation, either to protect himself or someone else who was involved. Still, many others believe that Karras and the Newburgh Heights Police Department were not involved in the murder, but simply negligent when investigating the case, and that the poor investigation was due to a lack of interest or concern. It has been 37 years since Kurt Sova's body was found near his home. For the rest of their lives, Kurt's parents fought for answers and to find justice for their son. They witnessed the corruption of the Newburgh Heights Police Department, and while they took solace in justice being served, it didn't lead to any new answers or insights into what happened to their firstborn son. Sadly, Dorothy and Ken Sova took the mystery to their grave, and all these years later, Kurt's case remains a baffling study. How a 17-year-old boy goes to a party, vanishes for days, and turns up dead in an area which has already been searched has never been sufficiently answered. A young man with a life full of possibility was taken far too early. If Kurt Sova were alive today, he would be 54 years old. Perhaps a father, maybe a grandfather, likely an uncle. A family was shattered, and to this day, relatives wonder what could have happened to the sweet and kind teenager they so lovingly remember. The death of a child is a bitter pill to swallow, and oftentimes grows like a cancer into all facets of the parents' lives, stealing away any possibility of joy or happiness for the future. While Dorothy and Ken had other children, the gaping hole left by Kurt's death festered for the rest of their lives. A haunting death and an utter lack of answers, made only worse by a corrupt police department that was either disinterested in justice or directly involved with the crime itself. All of these years later, and the death of Kurt Sova remains unsolved. But someone knows what happened, and hopefully, someday, the answers will come to light, and Kurt, along with his parents, may rest in peace after the revelation of the truth. The death of Kurt Sova is a case that has stuck with me ever since I was young. It's one of the first mysterious death cases I can remember hearing about. It appeared in season 1 of Unsolved Mysteries, a show which made a large impression on me when I was a kid, and one which has fostered an obsession with true crime throughout my life. That's a large reason why I selected this as the first case I ever covered, and to this day, I'm still baffled by this case. A 17-year-old boy went out to a party a week before Halloween and never came home. He went missing for days and then turned up dead in an area that had allegedly already been searched. It's been 37 years, and Kurt Sova's death remains as mysterious as it was the day it happened. The answers have never come, the story has never been explained, and Kurt's death has never been resolved. His family buried him without knowing why, and for the rest of his parents' lives, they were haunted by the questions. Their obsession threatened to break apart the family, but to leave it aside, in their minds, would be to have abandoned their son when he needed them the most. I chose to redo this episode for multiple reasons. Primarily, at the time when I recorded episode 1, I didn't really know what I was doing. My research skills were not as sharp, my format was sloppy, and I hadn't developed a way to truly handle the case in a way that I felt satisfied a listener. This case has a lot of information involved, and at the time, I wasn't sure how to handle it all. In the past year, I've learned a lot, and so I wanted to come back to this case and give it much more of a thorough examination. Also, it's disturbing, and it breaks my heart. Any case in which a parent must face the death of a child just absolutely destroys me. And this is one case that has been with me for nearly as long as I can remember. Only parents who have faced the incredible pain and anguish of losing a child could ever understand. I couldn't begin to fathom what Dorothy and Ken Sova faced throughout their lives. The sleepless nights, the endless questions, the pain of losing their firstborn. It's a nightmare no parent should have to experience. They worked long and hard to try and find the answers, to bring attention to their son's case, to stir up the whirlwind around the Newburgh Heights Police Department. In part, through their actions, they were able to shine a light on the corruption that existed, and over the years, local and federal law enforcement agencies were able to take action. While the Newburgh Heights Police Department was cleared out of its bad seeds, Kurt's case remains unsolved. In the absence of truth, we have theories. Some have been put forth by the family, some by friends and detectives, and others by internet investigators who have been looking at this case for nearly 37 years. The first theory explores the possibility that Kurt's death may have been exactly what it was ultimately ruled to be, a probable accident. According to statements made by the medical examiner's office, based on Kurt's autopsy, there was nothing outwardly that would suggest foul play. Kurt's body wasn't covered in bruises, there were no knife marks or gunshot wounds, there were minor cuts and scrapes, as well as signs of bruising on his shins and cheek, but nothing significant enough to immediately alarm them as to a possible cause of death. They ran toxicology on Kurt, finding that his blood alcohol content was 0.11%, which is a little less than halfway over the legal limit currently in the United States. This certainly wasn't high enough to indicate death could have come as a result of alcohol consumption. Blood alcohol content is measured, in an autopsy, by determining the weight of ethanol in grams in 100 milliliters of blood. How alcohol affects someone and how much it takes to impair them or incapacitate them varies based on factors such as height, weight, tolerance, gender, and body fat percentage. What may only give someone a slight buzz may result in intoxication for another, but there are general numbers which are considered close approximations. Since Kurt's blood alcohol content was 0.11%, that falls under a category described as being defined by significant impairment of motor coordination and loss of good judgment. Speech may be slurred, balance, peripheral vision, reaction time, and hearing will be impaired. According to the University of Notre Dame, alcohol poisoning doesn't begin becoming a possibility until the blood alcohol content of the victim reaches the range of 0.25% to 0.39%, which at its lowest threshold was more than double Kurt Sova's blood alcohol content. Alcohol poisoning can lead to the loss of consciousness, illness, and total confusion. The onset of a coma and possible death as a result of alcohol poisoning is associated with the blood alcohol content of 0.40% and higher. Suffice it to say, Kurt's blood alcohol content was not in a range whereby he should have been at risk of dying as a result of alcohol. Time also has to be factored into this examination. Kurt was missing for 5 days when his body was found. We have no confirmation of a time of death for Kurt, meaning that he could have died any time from the moment he was last seen at the party to the moment his body was found. Time of death plays a role in the determination of blood alcohol content. Improper storage of a body can actually raise the victim's blood alcohol content in a toxicology report because of the natural post-mortem fermentation process that occurs. Blood alcohol content has been proven to rise as much as 0.20% due to the body not being properly kept cool. Though we don't know Kurt's time of death, we do have to consider that he could have been dead for longer than a day or two. A standard protocol for toxicology is that the numbers can only be considered valid if tested within 48 hours of death. It has also been stated that, quote, high blood alcohol levels may develop during putrefaction, and levels up to 0.200% do not necessarily indicate that alcohol was imbibed before death, end quote. Depending on multiple factors such as environment and condition of the body, putrefaction generally begins within the first 48 to 72 hours after death. Suffice it to say, oftentimes, postmortem blood alcohol content is actually higher than it was at the time of death, rather than lower. These are all factors a medical examiner must consider and interpret. We have been told by multiple witness reports that Kurt had been drinking Everclear. It's been suggested that Kurt began drinking early in the day and continued well into the night. So the fact that Kurt's blood alcohol content was only 0.11% could signify two possibilities. Either Kurt hadn't been drinking as much as has been suggested, or Kurt was alive long enough for his blood alcohol content to have decreased, meaning that the idea of Kurt having died within a few hours of vanishing is unlikely. There are, though, other factors. Whether or not Kurt had any kind of an allergic reaction to alcohol is unknown, though possible. It's been said by his friends that Kurt drank from time to time, so it seems unlikely he was allergic, but it's impossible to know for sure. In addition to alcohol, The medical examiner also tested Kurt for cocaine and LSD, neither of which were found in his system. Why only these two? We can't be sure, but some have suggested the possibility that Kurt could have taken a drug that had a bad interaction with the alcohol and which ultimately led to his death. Without a more in-depth autopsy report, we may never know. The story about Kurt possibly being asleep on a cot in the basement could lend credence to Kurt having died days after the party. The sighting of Kurt on the side of the road yelling out the name Franco also plays a role in this. While we can't pinpoint Kurt's official time of death, there appears to be enough information to at least consider the possibility that he lived beyond the night of the party. Whether he was ill due to alcohol or drugs, or possibly in the process of dying, is unknown, but again a possibility. Those who support the death by accident theory believe Kurt likely became impaired due to some illicit substance in his system, and fearing legal action, those who were with him that night could have tried to nurse him back to health, and when it failed, elected to dump his body in the ravine. The location of his body, to me, has always suggested that whoever placed him there wanted him to be found. Also, Kurt's body being described as being in a crucifixion-like pose doesn't sound like a naturally occurring pose, but it's impossible to say for sure. The area he was left in was an area that was frequented by children and workers, not the kind of place you'd leave a body if you didn't want it to be found. It's also been argued that, if the story of that night is true, Kurt could have wandered off in a drunken stupor and ended up at the location where his body was later found, dying as the result of any number of possible factors. The issue with this is that Kurt's father claims to have searched that area and not seen Kurt. Also, men were working nearby and children were playing in that area during the days when Kurt was missing. It seems unlikely, though not impossible, that Kurt could have been in that spot the entire time. There's also the mystery of his missing shoe, having never been discovered, and his other shoe having been jammed into a pile of rocks. If Kurt were so incapacitated and drunk that he simply stumbled into the area, how does one shoe vanish and the other end up buried? Though we do have to consider the possibility that his other shoe wasn't found due to a poor investigation of the scene. Either way, these are all good questions that demand answers which have never come. The possibility that Kurt died as the result of an accident, be it due to alcohol or drugs, is certainly a possibility that has to be considered. The second theory in this case takes the opposite approach, suggesting that Kurt's death was not the result of an accident, but due to foul play. In terms of foul play, there are several individuals who are considered possibilities. We have those who were present at the party that night, the homeless man who made bizarre statements about Kurt in the days when he was missing, as well as Kurt's friend, Samuel Carroll, who told the story of Kurt vanishing. Beginning with the party, we don't know a lot about the attendees. We have been told that several people were present who were unknown to Kurt and his friend, having driven in from Detroit. Debbie and Clayton Sams hosted the party, though they were never investigated officially in terms of any possible connection to Kurt's death. There was a female roommate with whom they shared the apartment, and then there was the owner. All of these people played various roles in the case, with the owner alleged to have first denied Kurt was ever there, and then later to have supposedly said someone fitting Kurt's description was sleeping on a cot in the basement. It's certainly curious that his presence at the party was denied, but this doesn't necessarily suggest foul play. If you had a party, an underage kid showed up and got drunk, one of whom later went missing, it isn't hard to imagine someone would deny that to protect themselves. Later, everyone admitted that Kurt was there, though they claimed to have no knowledge of what happened to him. Samuel Carroll, Kurt's friend who attended the party with him, later told authorities that he had brought a very drunk Kurt outside, and that when he went to get their jackets, he came back and Kurt was missing. He believed Kurt had either wandered off or, more likely, had gotten into a car with someone, being that he wasn't gone long and Kurt was nowhere to be found. This is also a possibility, but many have called it into question, wondering if Carol knew more than he was saying. We have no way of truly knowing, and all these years later, Carol has never contradicted his statement. Is it possible that something more happened and Carol has never wanted to admit it? Absolutely, but without further information, it becomes nothing more than speculation. Then we have the homeless man, who told a store manager that Kurt was going to be found dead and that they wouldn't know what happened to him. Police spoke to the man, though the intensity of their scrutiny has been called into question considering what happened in the Newburgh Heights Police Department in later years. However, it's difficult to imagine that a homeless man who is alleged to have had some kind of psychological problems wouldn't have been more thoroughly looked at if there was even the slightest belief that he could have been involved in some way. The man was supposedly from Detroit, though his name and other information has never been revealed, if it's even known. Another bizarre connection between this man and Kurt's death is that he alleged to have made statements about stealing shoes from bodies, and one of Kurt's shoes was in fact missing. For years, people have speculated about this man's possible involvement in Kurt's death, whether he could have played a role or simply witnessed something. We may never know because, again, the investigation was so poor, there's no legitimate record of who this man is. He was not seen in the area again after police spoke to him, and it's essentially impossible to track him down 37 years later, assuming he is even still alive. So theories abound about the possibility of foul play. Could Kurt have been murdered by someone from the party? Could he have been involved in some kind of an incident with Samuel Carroll that led to his death? Could this homeless man have played a role? They're all possibilities, but we also have to consider the condition of Kurt's body. There were no outward signs of assault or any kind of foul play. While that makes it almost impossible that Kurt was beaten in some kind of an assault, it does open the door to the possibility that Kurt could have been drugged. Some consider the idea that Kurt may have been forcibly drugged, either by being told to take something or by having it slipped into his drink. Others have suggested that Kurt may have been offered a drug, chose to take it, and had a lethal dose or bad reaction. It certainly wouldn't be the first time a young man lost his life due to a poor decision made while drunk at a party. A woman who lived near the area where Kurt's body was found reported that, around 4 or 5 days after the party, she saw two men dragging another into the area. According to her, she thought the person was being dragged because he was drunk and the others were helping him home. This has never been confirmed, and police never questioned this witness. She also noted that the person being dragged was missing a shoe. If her statement is accurate, this means Kurt was placed in the ravine in the middle of the period during which he was missing. That would certainly support the theory that he'd been alive for a few days after, though doing what and in what condition we can't know. At the same time, Kurt's father alleged that he had searched the area just the day before Kurt's body was found, and there was nothing there. We can't confirm what this witness alleges, but it does seem to fit the location and condition of Kurt's body, though it does contradict Ken Sova's statement about his search. On top of that witness, we also have the statement from David Trusnik, a friend of Kurt's, who alleges that he saw Kurt 3 days after he disappeared. Trusnik stated that Kurt was walking along the side of a road with another person, and the two proceeded to a van, and he heard Kurt yell out the name Franco. Police didn't follow up on this statement either, but it again suggests the possibility that Kurt was alive for days after the party, though in this case, Kurt didn't appear to be in any kind of danger, and he was clearly not intoxicated. Trusnik's statement is a point of contention, with some believing him to be completely wrong, while others believe that he saw Kurt walking that day. Again, Another strange detail of this case that can neither be confirmed nor denied, but it does open the possibility that Kurt could have survived the party and later been involved in an incident which led to his death. For me, I've always felt that it was suspicious that Kurt would have been hanging around town in plain sight 3 days after his disappearance, when there were already search parties and flyers about him all over town. Foul play is a very difficult angle to examine in this case. There's a lot of options, and all of them are just as likely as anything else. When you factor in the denial of Kurt being at the party, the fact that Samuel Carroll never reported Kurt missing, and the behavior of the homeless man, how could these not be considered? In addition to the known people we have, there's a slew of others who could have played a role under the assumption that Kurt was alive for some time after he was missing. The homeless man was spoken to and sent on his way. The people who had the party, as well as the owner of the duplex, were never thoroughly questioned, nor was a search warrant executed on the duplex. Samuel Carroll has never been considered a suspect, and from what I've gathered, his official story has never been called into question. We may never know for sure, but Kurt's parents have always felt that foul play was involved in his death. It certainly isn't impossible, and for some, they've always felt that Kurt's death was connected to the death of Eugene Cavett. The connection to Cavett is interesting, but highly circumstantial. Cavett's death was ruled as a result of his falling into a ravine, and while Dorothy Sova felt that the missing right shoe may have been a connection to Kurt, the Cavett family never questioned the ruling. For them, Eugene had tragically died while playing, and they saw no reason to examine it further. It definitely is bizarre, the details, but there's little here to really work with. Some have argued that since Eugene and Kurt knew one another, they may have been connected by a possible killer. But again, that's a very speculative road to take. While I find the missing shoe detail captivating, it simply isn't enough to make much more out of. Also, no one has ever presented a possible motive as to why a killer would murder Kurt and then target a 13-year-old boy who had nothing to do with the crime in the first place. This leads us to the final theory, that Kurt's death was, in some way, connected to the corruption of the Newburgh Heights Police Department and possibly lead detective Robert Karras. We know that things weren't being handled properly by this department, and that Karras was involved in criminal activities. The question becomes, what would the link between Karras and Kurt have been? Some have suggested that Karras may have come across a very drunken Kurt, wandering the streets, and when he attempted to speak to or arrest Kurt, there was some kind of a struggle, and Kurt died as a result. While this is an interesting possibility, it calls into question the fact that Kurt's body showed no signs of trauma. If there is one thing we know about Karras, for sure, it's that he assaulted people. Kurt did not appear to be assaulted. Also, while I can agree that Karras is a deplorable man, would he be the type to have murdered a 17-year-old kid for no apparent reason? His past may be full of indiscretions, but murder has never been one of them. Others feel there's a possibility that Karras came across Kurt somehow in his drug trafficking operation, and that Kurt either ran drugs for him or purchased drugs from him. These are both highly speculative because there's never been a link established between Kurt and this kind of drug, only marijuana. It's possible that Kurt may have purchased or even sold, but what could have led to his death? Some have suggested that Kurt could have overdosed on Percocet purchased from Karras, or more than likely, someone who worked for Karras. Others believe Kurt may have simply witnessed Karras dealing drugs or interacting with a known drug dealer. I've always considered it highly unlikely that Karras was out on the street selling the drugs himself. Even if that were the case, and Kurt had purchased drugs and died as a result of them, at that time, no one knew Karras was involved in the drug trade in any way. We can't even be totally sure when his involvement in that activity began. it's certainly possible that Karras would have been trafficking at that time, but the idea of him willfully murdering Kurt Sova seems highly questionable, unless through the indirect action associated with a drug overdose. While I can see how many would believe that the Newburgh Heights police purposefully misdirected this case, I'm not sure that's what happened. Obviously, their investigation, or lack thereof, was despicable, but was it done to conceal some darker intentions? Would other officers put their jobs and possible jail time on the line to protect Karras? It's a possibility, but it seems more likely that the investigation was so flawed out of a lack of care or consideration. They were giving a ruling of accidental death by the medical examiner, and they didn't ask any questions. They simply accepted things as they were and moved on. Karras certainly wasn't a great investigator, nor someone who was interested in going above and beyond, but it's a great leap to label him as a murderer. We have no motive or physical evidence to support it. And while that could be because Karras himself led the investigation, it seems unlikely that out of all the people Karras dealt with over the years, he would choose to murder a 17-year-old kid and never cross that line again. It's a possibility, but again, there just isn't enough to work with. If Karras is guilty of anything, I would say it's more likely he's guilty of not caring, not doing his job, and not putting in any effort. Murder is a consideration, but again, we lack any real hard evidence to explore this further. The death of Kurt Sova is a tragic story, rife with confusion, contradictions, and shoddy police work. As sad as this case may be, it becomes even more disturbing when the fact is considered that the answers may have been found and the case may have been solved had the investigators at the time committed even the slightest bit of effort to determining what truly happened. As a result of their half-baked investigation, a 17-year-old boy was brushed aside and a broken and sorrowful family was ignored. The truth of what happened may never be recovered, with so much time passing and so little information available from the original investigation. The Sova family is still missing the answers they so desperately sought, and while Dorothy and Ken have sadly passed away without ever knowing the truth, there are others who live on and in whose hearts Kurt remains. Perhaps someday the answers will be found, be it by a confession, a new piece of evidence, or some new technology or procedure that has yet to be developed. Until that day, the death of Kurt Sova remains a tragic mystery for which there are no answers, and the case remains very cold and unsolved.
Case update. In late 2019, local media reported that the Newburgh Heights Police Department's cold case unit were partnering with Tiffin University students to re-examine the case and, hopefully, shine new light on the mystery which haunts his family to this day. Kurt's brother, Kevin, told reporters at a press conference, quote, "He was just a great kid. He had many friends. We just want to know the truth about what happened to my brother," end quote. Due to a lack of evidence, Kurt's case has never been listed as a homicide. However, Police Chief John Majoy is determined to get to the truth. There was no evidence of physical trauma, and so Kurt's death is being investigated as a suspicious death. Around the same time this case was being looked at again, CrimeCon announced that in February of 2020, they would hold a crowd solve event in which experts would speak to attendees about the case, present them with evidence, and then the attendees would help examine the case in hopes of determining what happened. While there have been no major updates to Kurt's case, digging back into the case is just the beginning. Many witnesses and people who knew Kurt have since forgotten details, and over 40 years, it's become difficult to figure out exactly what happened. There is hope, though, that Kurt's case is now receiving more attention, and after all this time, someone may be ready to talk. Any update regarding this will be pending in the future.
If you're interested in finding more information about the death of Kurt Sova, there are many websites and forums which discuss his case. Unsolved Mysteries ran a segment on Kurt's story in Season 1. If you have any information regarding the death of Kurt Sova, please contact the FBI. What do you believe happened to Kurt Sova? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. If you'd like to support Trace Evidence, please visit the Patreon page located at patreon.com/traceevidence. If you'd like to support Trace Evidence and don't want to join Patreon or make a donation through PayPal, you can look good and support the show at the same time. Visit traceevidence.threadless.com or click on the merchandise link on trace-evidence.com and get yourself a t-shirt, tank top, or an item of home decor to help show your love for Trace Evidence. I want to thank you for listening to this episode of Trace Evidence and invite you to check out our website at trace-evidence.com. You can find links to the Patreon, social media accounts, as well as places to go to download the podcast and subscribe. I'm always eager to hear your feedback. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a good rating on iTunes and leave us a review. This will greatly help our reach and bring more attention to the cases I cover. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.